VHS could come, hold him in a cell. A horrible fate he already knew well. So he decided he'd go back in the hope he could live in Salvador, somehow cope with the violence. But instead grief filled Francisco's heart when his boy was killed. But
he has only served the people,
no matter what they say.
Francisco is our neighbor,
and our neighbor he'll stay. His asylum case canceled despite all the evidence supporting his right to live in this world without being tortured somewhere where people are slaughtered. But such ideas now appear to be old-fashioned ones. In the land of the free, they'd rob him from his children, send him back to that country again. And
he has only served the people,
no matter what they say.
Francisco is our neighbor,
and our neighbor, he'll stay.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, I am continuing my conversation with John Helmer. John is the principal behind the news and analysis website Dances with Bears. He's an author, journalist, and educator. He spent decades living in and reporting on Russia. His academic credentials include teaching at Harvard and serving as political advisor to presidents and prime ministers from Washington to Athens. His book titles include The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison Which Fooled the World, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out. His latest article at Dances with Bears is about murder and honor these days. Your next previous article I mentioned before the break, John, is Bleeding to Death is Not a Russian Option. Russia's options seem to be diminishing. The Europeans are ever more avid, led by Ms. von der Leyen. Does this bill portend ill for the EU then? It'd solidify their absolute dependence on American energy supplies?
I believe, somewhat differently from the US podcasters, that we are in not only a war of the world, but in a revolutionary situation, a counter-revolutionary situation in Russia. What's happening, what we tried to explain a few minutes back, is that the Europeans and the United States, but led by the United States as an empire, are aiming to destroy Russia. The revolutionary element of that is the destruction of Russian public confidence in President Putin to continue effectively to manage Russia's future in an economic system whose base is the Russian oligarchy, first created in 1996 during the Yeltsin administration and sponsored and endorsed at the time by the United States. When you have an attempt to attack and break Russia into pieces, as this is a continuation of the war against Russia since 1917, when you have an attack aimed at just demonstrating to Russians that the oligarch base, guided by the President Putin's administration, can manage the future development of the Russian economy without mobilization of personnel to fight the enemy, without effective state planning and control to manage the distribution of resources. When you have an attempt to destroy the oligarch base and compel the presidency to nationalize assets, mobilize people, regulate the economy, then you have Russian oligarchs resisting President Putin's administration and resisting the war that the Europeans, the United States, and the U.S. empire are forcing on Russia for the permanent future. That's a revolutionary, counter-revolutionary context. Why am I embarrassed? Because in such a situation, it's very difficult to predict, on the one hand, what the president of Russia is prepared to do to keep alive his sense of balance, of mirror, of reciprocity that preserves the oligarch base on which he personally depends. which he has personally trusted for his entire term, it becomes more and more difficult for him to do that. And we're now seeing the signs of oligarch resistance, oligarch offense in preserving their position in this system under European attack. That's my long way of saying I'm trying to make a case for the imperial war is now transferred to a revolutionary situation, potentially inside Russia. And so then our audience can sort out which podcasters on this topic they believe. Those who are soft US imperialists, I don't need to go through their names, who want to modify the degree to which the war is damaging Russia in order to preserve the US protectorate, including their power to dictate to Russia what its future should be like, without an analysis and without a program for the future distribution of political power inside Russia. That's the, let's call it the big picture, the curtain that hangs in front of this particular stage. So having said all that and making my excuses for being using this method to analyze how the empire is working and succeeding in this war so far, it thinks. Let's come to your question about von der Leyen's visit to Kiev. Let's be clear what's happening here. Von der Leyen and the Germans in particular, but certainly the big powers, the UK, France, Italy, Germany, have committed to $70 billion financing each year for the next 2 years. That was the commitment of the G7 in Evian, and von der Leyen was participating in that. As we said, Trump signed that. The NATO six-point declaration in Ankara commits to a continuation. In that process, what we're seeing is the slow and rapid integration of Ukrainian war fighting within NATO operations, NATO bases. We've seen the illustration of that in Greece, where by accident, Ukrainian drone became uncontrollable, washed up, was found by fishermen on the west coast of Lefkada Island on the west side of Greece on the Ionian Sea. And Russian intelligence and Vovan and Lexus, the two pranksters, got out of the National Security Advisor of Greece, Thanos Dokos, the admissions that Greece is at war with Russia, that Greece is happy to have Ukrainian drone war units operating on Greek territory within NATO structures, so long as it doesn't damage Greek election prospects for the government, for the Mitsotakis government, and so on and so forth. Dokos even went to the extent of saying that the Ukrainians should target Russian businessmen in Greece if it can find them. In other words, kill Russians on Greek territory as part of the Greek government's war against Russia, a war that no Greek government has ever contemplated for 300 years of Greek fighting the empires that occupied it, principally the Ottoman Empire. So what we have is von der Leyen displaying that Europe is prepared not only to finance with its funds, with European taxpayer funds, for the continuation of the war to break up Russia, but it's prepared to do so as the humble, obedient, compliant servant of the United States, directed by its emperor, okay? And therefore, the $70 billion a year price that Europe is now prepared to pay, borrow and pay, and the price that the European member states are ready to pay as they remilitarize and change the base of their economies, that's a part of the compliance with the US empire in this war. And von der Leyen is simply a very compliant servant of the empire in this war. And she doesn't have the kind of election vote problem that Mitsotakis has in Greece, that Keir Starmer has had in London, that Macron's successors will have in France shortly, and so forth and so on. She is freer to act as the US servant in this grand scheme of war, permanent war against Russia, to achieve counter-revolutionary aims that have been unachievable by Europe and the United States since their intervention forces failed between 1917 and 1919 to overthrow the Bolshevik Revolution. That's how serious, deep, revolutionary and counter-revolutionary a moment we're in right now. And Canada isn't on the sidelines. Canada is in the center of this combination as a willing servant of the U.S. empire, paying the price for Trump's protection racket.
Well, and also serving as a home base to industries that are making weaponry to be sent into this conflict, as Russia is doing, or as Europe is doing, rather. Again, with this Skyfall compound that was bombed, it also includes a Skyfall Academy that teaches drone piloting skills to whomever. I'm not sure if it's just anybody can walk in or if it's just military people. But the idea that von der Leyen puts forward, too, is that the European industrial contribution to the Ukrainian drone manufacturing is all a one-way arrangement. She's rather cleverly obfuscating that it also goes the other way, that within Russia there are factories building specifically weaponry for the Ukrainian war machine. And this is where we get into Putin's being pressured in Russia to launch rockets at European targets that are producing its weapons.
Well, when we reach that point, and we are at that point, there's lots of discussion in the military blogs on the Russian side and in the podcast journalism on the US, North American, Canadian, European side of a Russian escalation to recapture the initiative on the battlefields and extend the war to NATO capitals using either conventional warhead-armed Oreshnik missiles, against which there's no European or U.S. air defense, or tactical nuclear weapons. Then we have this crucial discussion, serious, dangerous discussion of whether the Russian side is surfacing tactical nuclear war escalation against Germany, Latvia, the states that are allowing their airspace and their manufacturing systems to become direct participants in attacks on Russia, whether the Russian option of going nuclear is a bluff, another one of President Putin's red lines that he has allowed to cross without serious reaction, or whether we're approaching world war at a nuclear level. That's the point at which we've reached. Why hasn't President Putin and the general staff adopted this policy? Let's think about it for a minute. First, it's been the economic base, which we've just described, and the political decision-making and commitments of President Putin to maintain as normal a life for Russian voters as possible while enduring the most serious war waged against Russia since Germany in 1939. 200,000 at least Russian lives have been lost so far. Compare that to the 58,000 to 60,000 U.S. lives lost during the Vietnam War. The loss of life in Russia, I'm not talking about Ukraine now, I'm talking about Russia, is so serious, so unusual, that we have to give President Putin the credit for continuing to maintain high level of stable approval of his performance of maintaining normality in the Russian economy, normality including the oligarch-driven structure of that economy. Okay. What we now have is the loss of confidence that that this structure keeps the sky safe, keeps the car fuel tank full, that allows the trains to run more or less on time, the aircraft to run, that preserves Crimea as part of the Russian Federation, that preserves Donbass as part of the Russian Federation, that preserves our harvest, our export capacities of all goods and services, that preserves Russian ships on the high seas off the west coast of Greece, in the Mediterranean, or in the Sea of Azov, close to Russia's weak ports. All of this is now put at risk. What happens if Russia goes nuclear in attacking the drone sources in Germany, the use of Estonia's airspace and Latvia's airspace for drone attacks? What happens if the Russians escalate to nuclear? One, what President Putin's afraid of is that this will consolidate the US control of Europe and end any prospect of a negotiated settlement led by Trump against the Europeans. That's been, and folks can look up Kirill Dmitriev's hourly tweeting on this subject. That's the core of the Dmitriev line: preserve Trump's independence of the Democratic Party in Congress and the Europeans for escalation in Europe. A tactical nuclear escalation would consolidate the NATO alliance in the permanent war. That's what would happen on the border. You would take out by tactical nuclear method the target. Would you deter then Europe and the United States from their escalation? Would you bring them to the peace table by going nuclear? The assessment, so far as I can tell from my sources, I'm not making this stuff up. I'm trying to say the Russian assessment is not Sergei Karaganov's, the leading advocate of tactical nuclear escalation. It's not his. The view is that were there to be such escalation, the effect on the US-European side would be more war, not less, would deter Europe no more than the current demonstration effects of Oreshnik. That's part one. Part two is also controversial, highly so. If Russia goes nuclear, we then enter a clear world war situation, and that would destroy the oligarch base on which Putin depends. Russia could no longer, the Kremlin, the presidency, could no longer deliver the optimistic commitment to the future on which most Russian voters depend and believe. It would lead to the anathema for Putin, state planning, communist era controls of manpower. It would lead to mobilization of the public to fight on the front and in self-defense and in all forms of war, defense and offense, that would occur when the war becomes world war at a tactical level. So I hope I'm making a case here, not my invention, but rather the Russian belief that escalating to nuclear level removes all limits on the escalation ladder, makes the war world war without limits, and destroys Putin's political structure internally. Now, lots of folks, but they're not professors at the University of Chicago, and they're not ex-CIA veterans, and they're not veterans with colonel rank from the United States Army. Those folks are not socialists. They're not left-wingers. They're not even what President Trump calls communists. They are not committed to the revolutionary transformation of Russia without the oligarchs. Pardon me, there are none of those things. They want to dictate to Russia and dictate to our audience the best outcome for Russia would be a victory of President Putin plus the oligarchs plus the general staff, deterring and crushing Ukrainian resistance and splitting Europe from the United States, et cetera, et cetera. They make their own arguments. What they do not do is to address the future economic base of Russia, and that becomes entirely contingent, vulnerable, and likely for overthrow if Russia escalates to nuclear. I hope that's clear that there are domestic reasons why firing weapons at a German drone plant do not end the war. In fact, they bring the war home to Russia in a way that President Putin can't tolerate.
Well, and as you say, though, that this isn't a war necessarily against Ukraine. This is a broader war against America, its empire, and its satraps. So defeating Ukraine doesn't seem to be a way to ending this war either. And in your latest article, about murder and honor these days, you say that there of course is always a split within any government of interests. You write that it is the recommendation of the general staff, this is the military, the Pentagon, if you like, of Russia, the defense ministry, and the majority of the Security Council that Putin should drop the mirror, decide on asymmetrical measures, and authorize endgame escalation. Quote, that decision is days away, one of the sources said over the weekend. How likely is that escalation, John, and what does it mean? We only have a few minutes left.
I wish I could answer that question, Chris, to your satisfaction and to encourage our audience listening. And I invite everyone to write in to you or to me with their questions to see if we can produce a more confident answer. I'm not confident I can give an answer. My sources were saying, and that's why I reported, the decision being days away. There were various signs, which I'd rather not get into because they exposed the sources, that indicated this timing and that indicated that E-Day, escalation day, decision-making was imminent, was being ferociously discussed and debated at the moment. Then what happened, and it's a time sequence, then what happened was that President Putin at election rally made the mirror statement, the magic mirror statement, that Russian retaliation would be precisely mirrored but more powerful. Once he reiterated the mirror, he's reiterating the commitment to restriction on escalation, to matching what the other side does. That tends to suggest he's refusing to escalate to E-Day. Then Foreign Minister Lavrov, answering a question in a press conference with a Chadian foreign minister in Moscow, made the commitment or the form of words to dealing with pure terrorism as the underlying character of the Ukrainian escalation at sea, in the Sea of Azov, which is a direct threat to the Russian wheat harvest. It's cutting Russian wheat exports by at least 10% for the next couple of months. If it persists, then Russian grain storages are overwhelmed and we have a very serious damage to the agricultural sector on the same scale, and it's not an insignificant scale, as we've seen in the fuel and energy sector. When Lavrov reiterates pure terrorism as the meaning of what's happening, not war, then we are stuck. We are not changing the basic commitment to special military operation, not war, the oligarch structure of the Russian economy to deliver the future, the prospects of an election in which United Russia, the ruling party, will, by fair means or foul, preserve its majority in the State Duma. We'll have resistance to popular mobilization of manpower. We will have resistance to state planning of allocation of resources. We will have fixes, patches, modifications, and jawboning in an economy controlled by the oligarchs, regulated by the central bank governor with high interest rates. We will have more of the same. And I've spent rather a long time with those books you mentioned, Chris, analyzing case by case that this is the kind of balancing act that is President Putin's fundamental decision-making style. It's the way he thinks as a politician, thinks as a tactician. He tries to balance competing advice while retaining his fundamental commitment to a system of oligarch economy. What we now have is a situation in which he's being forced to balance opposites. And you can't balance opposites. You simply can't. So he has to come down one way or another. And this week, it seems, he's coming down the way he's always come down, with the magic mirror. That means no E-Day. That means my sources are, let's say, for the time being, mistaken. There will be no major surprise escalation. But well, I could be wrong.
Well, and you quote those sources as saying the alternative is that it is too little too late and that Russia will be defeated by a thousand cuts. They seem to be losing on the grand scale with the sea war that we've talked about before and the land war. And now others are being drawn into the orbit, Turkey especially, the S-400s and everything else is another topic. John, we don't have time to go any further than that today. Thanks a lot for coming on, though, and bringing us news that we won't get in any other way or very unlikely to on this side of the world.
Thank you for having me, Chris, and a big salute to you because you're carrying the burden of trying to convey messages which are not only not in the mainstream media, pardon me, but as I've tried to say, in the soft empire media, of the US podcasters who want to preserve their influence, their image of the way Russia should fight this war, and which ultimately means preservation of the status quo, the oligarch system in Russia, in what the oligarchs hope can be a combination of oligarchies of the world. Oligarchs of the world unite, because you have nothing to lose but your money.
Well, as long as we're allowed to do that, which in the West seems to not be a promise, and we're seeing more and more journalists that would put truth to the lie being intercepted by the police forces and others. Well, that's all I got for this week. Until the next time, thanks a lot again, John.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much.
No matter what they say, Francisco is our neighbor. Pressure was too much to take when he knew DHS could come hold him in a cell. A horrible fate he already knew well, so he decided he'd go back in the hope he could live in Salvador, somehow cope with the violence. But instead, grief filled Francisco's heart when his boy was killed. But he has only served the people, no matter what they say. Francisco is our neighbor, and our neighbor, he'll stay. His asylum case canceled despite all the evidence supporting his right to live in this world without being tortured somewhere where people are slaughtered. But such ideas now appear to be old-fashioned ones. In the land of the free, they'd rob him from his children, send him back to that country again. And he has only served the people, no matter what. Francisco is our neighbor, and our neighbor he'll stay.